Hello and welcome to the Sobremesa podcast. As always, I'm your host, Alan Maguire. This episode of the podcast has been split into two due to the length of the interview. And I must say, this is one of the most interesting interviews that I've ever conducted. I knew the history of anarchism in Spain to a degree. I can say that I knew of anarchism in Spain and part of its history from reading many Spanish books, but often in the sort of mainstream history books about Spain's modern history, anarchism is often played down or not fully explained. So it was an absolute pleasure to interview Danny and Jim from the ABC podcast, the Anarchist Book Club podcast. And I think in this interview you get a real sense of the importance, but also the size and what it really meant for anarchism in Spain. So I hope you enjoy the episode as much as I did recording it. And don't forget to head on over to Danny and Jim's podcast, the Anarchist Book Club. I'm a listener now and it's fascinating and quite fun to listen to.
Okay, so with me today on the Sobremesa podcast, I have Danny and Jim from the ABC podcast, the Anarchist Book Club. Welcome, guys.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for joining me. Today's main topic is obviously anarchism. I suppose most of the listeners of this podcast will have come into contact or seen that, you know, Spain as a country in itself is quite an important place for anarchists. I think most people come across the anarchism of Spain via the book Homage to Catalonia, you know, George Orwell's famous sort of description of Barcelona under anarchist control when he gets there and, you know, not tipping people and saying salud, no buenos dias, and, you know, all those sorts of. It's quite a bit romanticized, maybe some might say. And then obviously the following on battle from that. And I suppose, you know, for people that still live in Spain as well, they might see anarchism through the work that the CNT does. So I've taught at places that have had CNT representatives and, you know, they're still a big part of modern Spain. You know, all these images. I just thought I would ask you basically first, a very basic question. What is anarchism and what is the difference between anarchism and syndicate anarchism or syndical anarchism? Because I think they're both very quite specific things, aren't they, in Spain. So yeah, whoever wants to take that big question on, feel free to go.
I suppose we probably both got something to say about that. I don't mind saying first.
Go for it.
I suppose anarchism, the basic answer would be something along the lines of a historical answer would be that anarchism is the part of the socialist movement that disagreed that the priority of socialists should be to take power in a given nation state. So developing from that disagreement, the anarchist position has been that, that social change will come about through direct action and not through engagement with state bodies. And the goal of anarchism is not to achieve a kind of transitional state that would manage a change towards socialism, but instead the goal would be to dismantle the state and then allow socialism to flourish in the context that follows. But probably not that simple. You know, that's a simple answer to the question, but anarchism as a kind of umbrella term encompasses all kinds of different approaches to life and to politics that probably would exceed the bounds of a single podcast episode to answer. But I think that kind of historical framing is useful to bear in mind for thinking about the importance of anarchism in Spanish history in particular. And anarcho-syndicalism is like one strategic element of the anarchist movement that becomes, that develops out of what was originally called revolutionary unionism at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, and which had a good deal of support and adherence in places like the United States, Argentina, France, as well as Spain. In Spain, the main organizational manifestation of revolutionary unionism was the CNT. And because of the anarchist influence within the CNT, that revolutionary unionism came to be called anarcho-syndicalism, largely because it became tied specifically to the end goal of anarchists, which is libertarian communism.
Right. So just going back to your sort of original description, and you say it's not about dismantling the state. So it's more about, it's not about standing in elections, parliamentary elections. It's more about forming trade unions. And I think one thing that really struck me during the COVID, here in Spain and in the UK was mutual aid schemes. And it was a really big thing of anarchism. So the CNT, what does it stand for, and where did it start?
Danny's pointing at me because I wrote a book on the kind of formation of the CNT, so I guess that's on me. But it stands for the Confederación Nacional del Trabajo, the National Confederation of Labour, and that emerges in sort of 1910 to 1911 as a national organization. It actually has a precursor in Catalonia called Solidaridad Obrera, which remains a CNT newspaper as well, that title, so Workers' Solidarity. But then depending on how far back you go, really, you can look at the origins into the 1870s, late 1860s, 1870s. As Danny said, if we're thinking about anarchism as a historical movement, a political movement, rather than, say, just a general sort of philosophical tendency against authority, which, the two can get slightly intermingled, but I think, again, it's helpful to think of it as, in this movement form. In Spain, it had always been close to the workers' movement. When you get the first international forming around Europe, the organisation that Karl Marx was a part of, many kind of emerge out of this. At the start, it's a real mixture of anarchists and socialists and other kind of tendencies on the left. In Spain, that always takes a more kind of anarchist-ish sort of form, style. And so it's always quite close to organized labor. So through the 19th century, the end of the 19th century, you get various attempts to form a national union confederation. There's one in the 1880s that falls apart through disagreements. And so that desire to kind of organize through labor has been a part of anarchism in Spain since its origins. But when you get into the early 20th century, that's when these ideas that Danny said about syndicalism, they start coming into the movement, again, chiming with things that anarchists in Spain have already been doing. Now they've got they're very inspired by what's happening in France. A big similar organization called the CGT has formed there. And so you get this nucleus of syndicalists and anarchists coming together in Barcelona. They form Solidaridad Obrera, and then that expands in 1910 to 11 into the CNT. Up until the First World War, it's basically repressed and it doesn't really have an existence rather than a name. And then during the crisis that affects Spain during the First World War, you get this mass expansion of the CNT. And really it's that kind of 1917 onwards that you're talking about a mass organization across Spain that claims figures are always very elastic with the CNT. It's hard to pin it down. But around 1919, they claim the support of around 800,000 members. So that's when we're talking about a real national presence, a major player in Spanish politics.
And you talk about the crisis of the First World War. How did it affect Spain? And what sort of pushed this you know, this working class organization to be formed? You know, what really gave it the boost? What was the crisis that came from the First World War? Because Spain weren't a part of the First World War, were they, really?
No, Spain didn't join the First World War, but like you can still imagine it was still profoundly affected by what went on. So in general, you know, Spain attempts to supply both sides in the First World War. They have a huge economic boom, but then that also brings crisis. There's rampant inflation, also a real kick into urbanization. Barcelona swells in size. At this point, it's a very turbulent time, and it's a turbulent time for national politics. You know, you have the crisis of the restoration system, which has been in place since the 1870s, so similar time to the anarchist movement. That's clearly falling apart. And then also, yeah, you get this surge in the anarchist movement. Now, they go into the war, as I said, repressed, and they actually fracture in a very profound way at the start of the war about what their position on the war is. The majority, based around the CNT, adopt the kind of classic anarchist position of anti-militarism, anti-war, we want nothing to do with this. But a small minority, but an important minority, are kind of in favor of the Entente, in favor of France in particular. They kind of go along with some others in the international anarchist movement who say a victory for the Entente is preferable, and so we'll do that. So whilst this might seem a slightly obscure kind of internecine discussion, what that argument does is it puts the major figures in the movement in the same room for the first time since the CNT was founded, really, in trying to settle this difference. And they don't settle that, but what they do agree on is we need to get the CNT expanding again. And so that's when you have almost, it's a dirty word for anarchists, but it's almost a centralization or an increased centralization from where they are. You know, the CNT starts to operate as a national body. They start to push out their newspaper as a daily publication rather than a weekly one. And that then overlaps all of the small fractured publishing culture that's going on in Spain. And this kind of coming together, I think, of crisis, of mass movement of people internal to Spain, plus, you know, the CNT kind of getting its house in order, starts to kind of meld those things together. And that's when, you see the rapid expansion of the CNT.
It might be worth also just pointing out that that this is like the beginning of where you can see like Spain as different to other, particularly European countries in terms of like the longevity of anarchism.
Right.
As an organized force, because Spain is, the process that Jim's just described is like the opposite of what's happening to socialist and anarchist movements in all of the belligerent countries as a consequence of this division that's taken place with the outbreak of the First World War. Mm. And so when the Russian Revolution happens, there are like disaffected minorities within socialist and anarchist movements all around Europe that then become the sort of nuclei of communist parties. Because of the sort of increasing coherence of the CNT and because of this majority anti-war position that it's been able to adopt in the circumstances of neutrality in Spain, that doesn't, there isn't that constituency for the creation of a kind of Bolshevik-style party in Spain in the aftermath of the First World War. And therefore, this, you know, anarchism is able to retain a kind of majoritarian or at least like a prominent position within the workers' movements in a way that it doesn't in any other country in the world.
Wow. And where does Primo de Rivera sort of, because you know, not his son, the founder of the fascist party, but the dad, the dictator. Where does anarchism fit under this? Because my brief understanding was that he repressed the CNT. So did it balloon before or after him?
It reaches like this peak of membership that Jim just talked about around 1919. This is after Spain has effectively kind of ridden out the so-called Trienio Bolchevique, like the three Bolshevik years. which is a misnomer in the sense that it wasn't 3 years or Bolshevik.
Right.
But it was like a kind of revolutionary crisis that Spain underwent.
Mm-hmm.
But in the aftermath of this, there's an employers' offensive against, particularly against anarchist labor militants. And this gives rise to the years of so-called pistolerismo, where hired gunmen of the bosses' associations start a sort of tit-for-tat warfare with anarchist militants and activists. And this is where you have like the rise of the famous men of action of the CNT that would then, you know, in many respects be like the kind of blooding ground for what would become some of the key figures of the generation of 36 that would lead the revolution and war. It's also the year in which, this is also the period in which the great CNT leader, Salvador Seguí, is gunned down in Barcelona. And it's in that sort of context of crisis and gun battles and so forth that Primavera is able to present himself as a sort of figure of law and order who's going to reimpose order in Spain. That combined with the ongoing rebellion against Spanish rule in the Protectorate of Morocco.
Mm.
So it's that combined like problem of like colonial crisis and the sort of crisis of violence engendered by like, a radical labor movement and a very violent response on the part of the bosses that allows Primavera to come in, present himself as the sort of, you know, iron surgeon who's going to bring peace, social peace to Spain and its protectorate. And yeah, he represses the CNT as a matter of priority. And importantly for how like Spanish politics is going to develop, the UGT, the Socialist Trade Union, are initially at least allies of Primo de Rivera, and they end his government. So thereby, you know, creating a lot of resentment and you know and mistrust that's going to take a long time to overcome, or possibly never is overcome.
Well, and yeah, I remember reading that about the UGT. I was really surprised. I read it in a few places, and it sort of said that they basically did it to get the membership. Like, I don't know how true that is, but was there a big shift in working class alliance between the anarchists and the socialists? And I suppose the other question is, you know, how involved were the working people as part of, you know, the anarchist sort of philosophy, or was it more of a case of collectivized action, or was it a bit of both? Do you see what I mean, mate?
Yeah, so just to start on the question of the socialists, I think it's important to note that, you know, the socialist movement emerges at a similar time to the anarchist movement. It's a little bit after. Mm. And they are, from the outset, you know, kind of explicitly positioned in some ways against what anarchists are doing. Like, they are very concentrated on parliamentary means, on trying to get elected. They put a lot of emphasis on that, a lot of emphasis on centralization, on kind of hierarchies. So they are almost forming in opposition to one another. Mm. And yet, in many ways, kind of appealing to the same groups of people. You know, I've done some work on this, and there's some existing work, at least in the early days. There isn't a massive difference in who makes up these unions. It's similar sort of trades across Spain. You know, in both movements, you see lots of tradesmen, of laborers, construction workers. Where the differences tend to lie are in geography, at least, again, in the late 19th, 30th, 20th century. So as we've said, Barcelona is this real strong point for the CNT, and then you can say Madrid really is a strong point for the UGT and the socialists. There are, you know, there are presences of each other movement in both those places, but then, you know, the north is kind of split again. Gijón in Asturias tends to be more anarchist, whereas the Basque regions tend to be more socialist. Andalusia tends to be more anarchist. You know, there are these regional variations, but it's not always apparent as to why that's the case. And I think that goes into your other point about, you know, how, you know, clued up on the philosophy of anarchism is everyone in the CNT? I would say perhaps, you know, not massively, but then there are also plenty of working class people who are in the CNT. I think it is a mixture, and people are drawn to different aspects of it. You know, some people are drawn to the philosophy, some people drawn to the culture, some people drawn to the real push they put on education, on gender liberation, and those kind of things. Some people, probably because the CNT is the union that organizes in their workplace, so that's the union they join. You know, I think it's not easy to pinpoint that as a particular reason for why someone would join one than the other. Someone once said to me, after I tried to give a sort of long and labored explanation as to differences between the two movements, and he just said, well, it could be that, like, in one town the CNT had better songs, so that's where people went. So, you know, but also I wouldn't want to undermine the fact that, you know, there was a big working class interest in anarchism, and that's undeniable, and that people did know it and people did want to learn about it as well. So a bit of both is my unfortunate sort of fence sitting answer.
No, it makes complete sense, really. And the back to like Primo de Rivera's time and his repression of the CNT, did that really alter the future for the anarchism in Spain, or not too much?
I think that's a good question. I don't know, really. Lots of the key activists are forced into exile during Primo de Rivera's time. Mm. Like some of the most famous people, Durruti, García Oliver, have to get out of Spain, but also like much lesser known names as well. You know, there are whole like communities of anarchists in France, Belgium, places like that in the 1920s, setting up newspapers, setting up like prisoner support funds and things like that. So I suppose in the sense of like that those kind of like support networks in exile, that's providing like experiences that are then gonna have to reemerge in the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War as well. Mm. But in terms of like how the Primo de Rivera experience impacts on the immediate future of Spain itself, I'm not sure. I mean, I suppose a lot of it's like to do with like timing and things. So like, it creates this interlude in the 1920s, which is a time like when, say, for example, in other European countries, the communist parties are becoming like Bolshevized and things like that. I mean, to an extent, like I suppose Spain is inured from some of those kind of some of those broader European like political developments on the left of the labor movement, creating like new sort of fractions and divides within the labor movement. And I suppose the CNT kind of is able to sort of reemerge, sort of start from where it left off in once Primo de Rivera falls. There are like, you know, the kind of subplots going on. Like, so for example, the fact that Spain is under dictatorship in this period leads the CNT into some tentative alliances with non-anarchist organizations. So there's a case of anarchists supplying explosives to Catalan nationalists. I think it's like towards the end of the 1920s. Now I'm going to get muddled up here, but they either supply explosives to Dencas or one of the Badia brothers, who then become, during the Second Republic, these kind of like archetypal figures of Catalan bourgeois law and order, and like the like number one enemies of the CNT. Oh. In this period, there's a kind of like rapprochement between like figures like that, because they have this common enemy in the dictatorship. And I guess, you know, that's something that was drawn upon by figures within the CNT when trying to justify alliances with non-anarchist figures during the Civil War as well. And this does create a degree of consternation. So like during the Primo de Rivera era is also when you have the foundation of the FAI, which is a very important like anarchist organization, the Federación Anarquista Ibérica, which is a federation of affinity groups, And most of those, you know, the whole point of the FI basically is to try and maintain an anarchist presence within the CNT. So its principal concern, although there's a wide variety of opinion within it, I suppose the principal unifying concern is that the CNT, because of like these alliances that it's making with, say, Catalan nationalists or like Republican figures, there's a potential of that if it's anarchist content being like diluted.
Mm.
So the FI exists to kind of like retain a kind of anarchist pole of attraction within the broader labor movement. Right. Sorry, that seems like a pretty like long-winded kind of answer.
No. That was an adjustment to add to that, Jim?
Just very briefly, in that I would say that whilst the Primo regime is repressive towards the anarchists, and it does, as Danny says, force people into exile, it's also relatively short, you know, in the grand scheme of things, and it's akin to other periods of repression that the movement's faced before and come out of quite strongly. In a way, the movement knows what to do in a circumstance like this, when their newspapers are shut down, their unions are closed, and, you know, whilst it might seem surprising perhaps that the CNT can go from strength to then being repressed under Primo and then to spring back with such strength, that's a pattern that's occurred again since the 1870s. I think that's also what marks it out from the Franco, you know, period, if you're looking for distinctions. You know, the Primo regime is 7-8 years, you know, rather than decades and decades, and yeah, it's that long-term repression, I think, that really breaks things. Whereas, you know, it's obviously a very difficult time for the movement, the 1920s, but it's not an insurmountable kind of block that is put in their path.
And I suppose the fall of Primo de Rivera brings us round to the founding of the Second Republic. The Pact of San Sebastian between the like liberals and the socialists, because they're angry because, you know, Alfonso XIII won't sort of basically bring back any form of democracy. That's quite like a famous example of groups working together to found the Second Republic. But the anarchists are also obviously quite a big force within the Second Republic in AMIL and its formation. So what part did they play in it, and what was general like views towards the Republic?
Well, the CNT activists play like a fairly important role in something like the kind of the foundational acts of the Republic. Kind of like, I suppose, a sort of auxiliary supportive role. You know, CNT activists are present in Barcelona, like helping people like Luis Companys occupy, his seat of regional governments and things like this. And most of the history talks about a kind of truce, or like an initial feeling of like of the CNT hoping to use this like opening of democracy in Spain to like regain its forces and sort of stabilize and consolidate itself after this period of repression. The problem is, and this is like something that Chris Elam's book Anarchism in the City really illustrates very well, is that the fact that like unions can return to work in under the Republic means that there's a huge groundswell of interest among like ordinary people in trying to improve their life conditions. So the CNT is like almost immediately besieged by new members who want to use the CNT to like improve their conditions of labor and so forth. And so the CNT is pushed into lots of very big strikes, and you know, the Republic has a choice really, and it's a jump which way it's going to go. You know, it has in its the first article of its constitution says the Republic is going to be a republic of all classes. It's like, well, you're not. You have to choose, and that's what really like, you know, the first like months of the Republic established. You know, and they choose like any incipient state would choose. They choose like to try and stabilize the situation through like repressive measures against activists and so forth. And that really sort of brings about a crisis between those, I suppose, more like pragmatically inclined gradualist figures within the sort of CNC leadership, and the people who are more inclined towards like sort of revolutionary insurrection, who are hoping that, you know, this like wave of worker militancy is going to, you know, generate a sort of second revolution, if you like, in the aftermath of the founding of the Republic. You know, there are certain episodes that sort of are illustrative of how this kind of like initial truce with the Republic is short-lived. So, for example, in Fagols, which is a mining district in Alt Llobregat in Catalonia, the people live in labor colonies where everything is owned by the Counts of Fagols. So, you know, they get paid in like tokens that they are redeemable only in like company stores. And, you know, it's like a kind of feudal sort of institution whereby like this count, who's a Scouser, as it happens, like born in Liverpool, Count of Fagols, like owns, basically controls people's life, you know, from like cradle to grave. And obviously there's an anticipation when the Republic comes about that kind of like appalling situation is going to alter. And when it doesn't alter, they rise up in desperation in the beginning of 1932. But what sort of sets apart this like desperate and relatively easily repressed insurrection is that this comes at a time when the CNC is already starting to fracture as a result of its, you know, like attitude towards the Republican state. Mm. But also because these workers are animated by the anarchist ideal. And very significantly, when they take over very briefly the town of Fagols, they declare libertarian communism. You know, they raise a red and black flag. They say, okay, from this point on, you know, we're going to abolish money. We're going to, you know, there's going to be no more police. You know, that let the anarchist society begin effectively. And this has a massively like sort of energizing and exciting effect on like anarchist activists and propagandists who, you know, who've known like theoretically that that you can transform society overnight. But this sort of proves that there's an appetite among like a wider working class constituency for that kind of activity. And so that really sort of, I think that I might be overstating it, but to me, it seems like that kind of like sets the agenda then for like one section of the anarchist movement, saying, okay, you know, we can concentrate on revolutionary transformation from this point.
And that sounds like that's why, you know, it's like the praxis, the hands-on work that really sets Spain apart from other countries when it comes to anarchism. Is that true? Is there any other? Is that a big feature of why Spain is so big for anarchists?
Am I going to go for the why is Spain? yeah, I think so. I think it's kind of chicken and egg as to why, you know, Spain maintain such a strong anarchist movement into the 30s, when really elsewhere that kind of mass organized anarchist movements, you know, are tiny. As Danny said, you know, you do get large anarchist movements elsewhere in the world in the early 20th century. Really, it's I would say the First World War breaks many of those. Like the French syndicalist movement, for example, is torn apart by its decision to enter the French war effort and so on. But again, I think there is an element of, now I guess I would say this, but going back to the mid 19th century, in that it there's almost like a kind of feedback loop, in that, like, you know, anarchism becomes popular in Spain quite early, and then, as I kind of discussed before, it kind of embeds itself in certain areas and grows from there, and it becomes a kind of a culture that maintains itself. So yes, that sort of hands-on attitude and some of the philosophical points, you know, seem to resonate according with Spain's, the conditions of Spain, the economy of Spain, the culture of Spain. But also, it's in a way, it's big enough in order to remain big enough. Mm-hmm. It's big enough to be able to do things which then attract members and, you know, make strikes large and so on. It's not just, you know, as you have in Britain, you know, a few people sat around saying we're the anarchist movement of Britain. Yeah. You know, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people. So, you know, in a way, it is that kind of reciprocal kind of thing, I think, that that maintains anarchism in Spain, along with the, you know, the big historical, you know, context, you know, Spain's position in the First World War, and as Danny said, Spain's experience of the 1920s with on a more national political level, which does set it apart from many other areas, which means that, you know, the same reasons which have caused the collapse of anarchism elsewhere haven't taken part in Spain, which was also in a stronger position to begin with.
Just to add to that, I mean, I agree with everything that Jim's just said, but in terms of like a kind of Spanish exceptionalism in this sense of like providing of practical examples, you could probably overstate it. I think like throughout this period, there is still like the Paris Commune still remains like a reference point, for example, for the movements in Spain. There's a famous article written by Mariano Orban Fernandez calling for a revolutionary alliance in Spain among anarchists and socialists. And in that article, he also refers to the Bavarian Soviet Republic. So, you know, like the short-lived revolutionary government that, you know, sort of Soviet-style government that existed in the aftermath of the First World War in Bavaria, in which anarchists and like Marxists participated together. So I think although, like, you know, something like these kinds of like insurrections that take place in the 1930s are extremely inspiring for the anarchist movement and sort of put libertarian communism as a specific goal on the kind of immediate agenda of the anarchist movement in Spain, I don't think that within, well, for most of the activists that I look at, they don't necessarily think of this as a uniquely Spanish kind of phenomenon themselves. You know, that they look to the history of the broader workers' movement, and they look to like these other examples and they consider themselves to be a part of that tradition.
And I think
going to ask if you could expand upon, just very briefly, what libertarian communism is for those that don't know, because it sounds like a contradictory term, but I know what it is from reading libcom.com, very good website if anyone wants to check it out. But I just wondered if one of you would mind explaining briefly what libertarian communism is.
So it's libcom.org, actually, the website, just in case anyone wants to check it out. But yeah, so libertarian communism in Spain is the declared goal of the CNT from, I think, is it 1918, 1919? Yeah, I think. So, you know, they say that this is what we're after from, and this is like in the immediate aftermath of the Russian Revolution. And I mean, it's just another way of saying anarchist communism. I mean, libertarian is a synonym for anarchism, for anarchist in Spain, in France, in numerous other places. You know, I think it's partly, you know, it's a peculiarity of the Anglophone world in that, that people don't necessarily make that connection straight away. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, it's intended to like distinguish itself from the Marxist conception of, it's only, that's the point of it, I suppose. Like this is something that emerges as a current of thought in the aftermath of the Paris Commune. There's a great book, Communal Luxury, by Kristen Ross, that talks about, you know, the debates in the aftermath of the Commune that lead to like this, I suppose, maybe codification is too much of an overstatement, but a kind of crystallization of certain anarchist ideas about the kind of society that they want to bring about, and the influence that the Paris Commune has had in like helping to envision that. And yes, I suppose anarchist communism is a way of saying that the classic communist goal of from each according to their ability, to each according to their need, would be established without a transitional state. Mm-hmm. In some ways, you know, Marx is coming to broadly similar conclusions himself in his own writings in the Civil War in France. You know, he talks about the state as a boa constrictor on the sort of communal upsurge that's taken place in Paris. But anyway, that's a bit of a tangent. So libertarian communism, in, as it becomes to be like understood in Spain, is a kind of is in the line of that anarchist communism that's developed in the aftermath of the Paris Commune. And there are lots of debates within the Spanish workers' movement as to exactly what it would entail. So like the broad understanding of it as, you know, a communist society without fixed authority, without a fixed government, without a state, is understood as like that's the basics. But, you know, how would it be organized in terms of, you know, economic coordination? And what would be like the units of self-government, and you know, how would we be talking about commune, or would we be talking about you know, a union organized society? These are debates that animate the anarchist movements throughout the 1930s. And in the run-up to the CNT's last Congress before the Civil War, which takes place in Zaragoza in May 1936, there's an enormous, like unique really, I think, in the history of the workers' movement, debate in which thousands and thousands of people through their like local union assemblies participate in like putting forward their vision of how libertarian communism would be. And so you get like these ideas about how like the borders would operate, how, you know, Spain would like have go through a reforestation process, or how like technology would be improved, or how, you know, gender relations would operate, or how like nudist colonies would function. You know, like a massive, like huge swathe of different ideas, right? In some ways, like mutually contradictory, in some ways, you know, quite esoteric in their concerns, but nevertheless, like a demonstration of not of, of the intellectual democratic culture that the CNT has been able to cultivate in Spain. And in terms of like ordinary people engaged in understanding how they could shape their own future, remains like a moving and incredibly like incredibly significant and interesting episode of history in and of itself, I would say.
Yeah, sounds it.
I just to follow on that, I taught for a couple of years a big course on the Civil War, and when trying to kind of explain where the anarchist movement is at in 1936, you know, I used this document that Danny's talking about from the Zaragoza Congress. And, you know, it always, you know, provokes really interesting discussions with students, you know, who aren't familiar with anarchism, you know, or, you know, what it's about, what it's meant to mean, you know. And I'll ask them to read this and kind of share their thoughts, and it's all, you know, I always hear something new because it's such a varied and rich document. You know, some kind of hard-headed students think that it's kind of ludicrous, you know, like why are they talking about what to do with, as Danny says, like nudists in the future society that isn't important on the eve of civil war, echoing some historians who say the same thing. And then other people saying, you know, this is inspiring. Or you get people saying, well, I don't know what this means. There isn't like an easy takeaway as to what anarchism wants. And in a way I have to say, well, yeah, that's kind of the point. You know, I've spent many years studying it, and, you know, it's hard to encapsulate in one small, you know, in one little takeaway thing. It's all of these things. It's an economic model. It's a cultural model. It's a critique of gender relations. It's a worldview that encompasses so much, and that they put this down as their, you know, what we need to decide, when, you know, many people knew or strongly suspected that something was coming, that a coup was coming. The movement was aware of this, and that, you know, and that they decided, you know, this is what we're going to discuss on the eve of the Civil War. I think is one of the best kind of reflections of how the movement thinks and works.
And I suppose that sort of reflects their relationship to the Republic. Could you expand upon the anarchist sort of, because I mean, there's obviously the Republic I mean, in Spain, if you go to any left-wing protest, the Republican flag is always there, and it's sort of a bit, you know, it's overly stated. You know, they forget to mention that it was, you know, liberals that were angry at the king that helped form it as well, and anarchists as well. You know, it wasn't just this sort of, I mean, obviously it was much better than Primo de Rivera and Franco, but you know, the dynamics within the Republic are often, I don't think, really stated clearly. So it'd be interesting to hear from you guys, what was the anarchist relationship to the Republic through all of the stages? I mean, there was the initial socialist period, and then there was like the sort of fight back from the right, and then that again, and then that sort of snowballed into the Civil War. So I just wondered if you could expand upon that bit.
I'll go briefly first, because I think Danny could speak much more on this, but one sort of takeaway of the Republican era, I think, as that's always kind of stuck with me, that I learned when I started studying this, was, you know, the narrative of the right in Spain during the Republican years is that it's a left-wing project that you know, is out to get them. But if you actually look at the history of the Republic, the Republican state constantly is attacking to the left. It's constantly, you know, knocking the anarchist movement on the head.
Right.
And I think there are moments of potential goodwill and, you know, acceptance, that, you know, perhaps this is a lesser of two evils, but I don't think that, you know, I think that they're also very much shaped by the experience that the Republic is constantly beating left. And that comes as much from the Republican kind of centrist elements of the Republic and the socialist movement, which does use the state apparatus to try and undermine the anarchist movement, undoubtedly, and to take some of its membership. So I think often, as you say, in a way, you know, the experience of the Civil War gets written back into the Republic. And so the anarchists are often kind of incorporated into that Republican kind of world. But and it's not totally wrong, I don't think, to see it that way. You know, there's definitely overlap. There's definitely some shared purpose. But also it is important to outline that, you know, you know, it is, to me anyway, that's how I see it. The Republican state is used to repress the left more than it is the right in this period.
Dan, have you got anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, I think that what Jim said is correct. I mean, there's so many different things that you could talk about in terms of like the Republican years and the anarchist movement.
Mm.
It's like one possible way to think about it is that the Republic in its birth opens up this possibility of change and transformation.
Mm.
For some people within the anarchist movement, that possibility for change is like limited to the organizing possibilities opened up by democracy, like to being able to reestablish themselves as a union, as a kind of before. And for others, it's like, maybe this is the opening of a kind of revolutionary period in Spanish society that we're going to be able to take advantage of and push as far as possible. But in the context of the 1930s, and it also in the context of the intransigence of the right in Spanish society and in opposing the kind of reforms of the Republic's first couple of years, that perspective shifts towards a kind of, you know, where does the anarchist project sit in relation to this specter of fascism that's like looming large in Europe and in Spain as well. Mm. I suppose there's a divergence between people who want to prioritize an alliance in that regard with like other non-anti-fascist forces, and others who look to, say, the experience of Germany and say, well, look, Germany shows that it's quite, it's a relatively simple process for a parliamentary democracy to transform itself into a fascist dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of like writing about Spanish anarchist movement that tends to, precisely because the anarchist movement wasn't really a movement of educated intellectuals. It was like autodidacts for the for the vast majority. Mm. But that doesn't mean that they didn't have like insightful, interesting things to say about what was happening, not just in Spain, but abroad as well. But I think partly for that reason, that you know, that element of Spanish anarchism tends to be denigrated.
Right.
But if you look at like the anarchist press in the aftermath of the Nazi rise to power, there's, I think, quite insightful analysis saying that, you know, we can't rely on people to our right, like non-revolutionary forces, to provide a bulwark against fascism. Like, look what's happened in Germany. You know, they've voted, you know, like Hitler is like put into power by this like deal with precisely with the old guard kind of powers within Germany, which also obviously have, you know, their equivalents within Spain as well. I mean, we're able to rely on anyone but ourselves and our own forces, you know. Also, you have like at the beginnings of, I mean, I don't know how influential this is, but you also have like some German refugees coming into Spain from this point as well, some of whom are anarchists, some of whom are in contact with the CNT and explaining their situation. And like one of the things you really get from the revolutionary movement in Germany, and it's like reflections, particularly like those outside of like the socialist and Stalinist parties, was that, you know, they had all these like organized workers, but they were never given an opportunity to actually fight. You know, the people just went off to like, you know, these like whole like neighborhoods that were like really strongly revolutionary in terms of like their composition. And yet they were just, you know, put down in a really like depressing and depressing kind of way.
Mm.
The anarchists see that happening and say, well, that can't happen here. You know, if we're going to go down, we have to go down with a fight. And that animates like things like the abstention campaign in the elections of 1933 and, you know, the general like sort of slogan of fascism or social revolution, you know, like saying that we're not going to be able to save ourselves through democracy, through like alliances. We can only do it through revolution. But there are like nuanced positions within that sort of broader divide that perhaps it would be tedious and pedantic to go through. But yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to like encapsulate the entirety of the like anarchist relationship with the Republic in that sense, but probably we could maybe split it up into those kind of like, at least in terms of that periodization, like on the one hand, like what does the Republic as an opportunity represent? And then what does the rise of fascism as a threat represent, and how are we best disposed to combat it?
And I suppose, Leon, talking about this, like the specter of fascism, they knew some sort of coup was coming. How does the anarchist movement respond to the Franco coup?